Welcome to Circle Sanctuary Network Podcasts, brought to you by Circle Sanctuary, one of the oldest nature spirituality churches in the United States, connecting people of nature-centered paths around the world. Join us through the week for a variety of shows discussing various topics, celebrating the divine in all of its forms through nature worship, rituals, education, and building bridges of community.
Good evening, good morning, good night, good second breakfast, whenever you are, wherever you are. My name is Laura Gonzalez, and I'd like to welcome you to Lunatic Mondays, Lunes Lunaticos, the very first bilingual show for CSMP, the Circle Sanctuary Network podcast. And today is a social justice series social justice series. Say that fast 7 times. Today, we're going to talk about allyship with people experiencing homelessness, and I am very honored and very happy to have once again my co-host and dear friend, Jake Bradley. Jake, welcome to Lunatic Mondays. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Laura. Happy New Year, everyone. Thanks again for having me partner with you on this series and for having this really important topic in January.
It is really important, and thank you, Jake, always for sharing your knowledge with us and for educating us. And you were telling me something that I think prompted this topic today, which is this count that happens on January. And we're going to go into the nuts and bolts of why people end up in this situation of being homeless. But what is this count that happened in January, and why was it important that we do the show this month?
Well, the thing you're referring to is called the PIT count, P-I-T, point in time count. And the Department of Housing and Urban Development, the federal government department that's in charge of addressing homelessness and housing and so on, across the nation, requires every jurisdiction to have what's called the PIT count, and they require it to happen in January at night, so that it's, you know, in the coldest part of the year, potentially, in most jurisdictions. And we could definitely dissect why we think HUD wants us to count homeless people in January, and how that is probably going to result in a smaller count and so on. But this is how the federal government generates statistics about how many people in this nation, across this nation, are experiencing homelessness for each year. And then they track it, you know, from location to location across the course of the year and across time, and compare one year from to the next to see whether or not there's any progress towards ending homelessness or decreasing it and so on. But so the PIT count happens. There's one that happens in your jurisdiction almost certainly. You may or may not have ever heard of it, but here in Chicagoland, it's on January 26th. And it's generally in that week in January across the whole nation. And so chances are, you know, if you do a little digging, you can figure out when it's happening in your area. But basically, in the really simplest way, like groups of volunteers and staffers from homelessness services agencies go around their whole area and attempt to identify and count, in quotations, everyone that they find who is experiencing homelessness. Now, the people that they're likely to find in the middle of the night on a cold night in January are much fewer people, obviously, than there are actually experiencing homelessness, because people who don't have a safe place to be are not very likely to be very visible, especially at night, because that's not safe. The people who are most likely to be homeless are more likely to be sort of active and try to find warmer places to be so that they're less likely to be seen, identified, and because of laws around the nation, which hopefully we can talk more about, because of stigma around the nation, which we'll probably address in one way or another. There are lots of reasons why people are not sort of obvious and conspicuous in their homelessness. And those people who are certain groups of people who may most sort of fit our stereotypes in our brains about people experiencing homelessness. Those who are more likely to be able to actually be visible in their homelessness, you know, generally men, older people, single people, and so on, which doesn't at all represent who's experiencing homelessness in this nation, but those are the folks that you're more likely to see out there in your cities and in your areas, because they're the ones less likely to sort of blend in or be invisible because they might have greater safety than other folks who can't afford to be identifiable. So, you know, on that pit night, you know, volunteers go around and they look for people they think might be homeless, and they wake them up if they're asleep, and they approach them and ask all sorts of questions about their homelessness and why they became homeless and whether they're experiencing mental illness and things like that, which are really awful questions to have to answer for a stranger, especially if you were not planning on interacting with someone. And then they come up with a number, which HUD uses as, you know, there are this many homeless people in this particular area in the nation. And still, even though you can imagine how hard it is to find people who are willing to say, yes, I'm homeless, and willing to answer those questions, even though it's really hard and, you know, the statistics are really not, don't make it likely that we're actually going to find all the people experiencing homelessness and count them all. But even though that's true, we still count hundreds of thousands of people experiencing homelessness every January in the United States. I can give you actual numbers, I guess, if you want, but that's what the pit count is.
Thank you for explaining that so clearly. And I cannot explain, Jake, how culturally shocking was to come from a country like Mexico, who experienced poverty and is a so-called third world country. And from Mexico City, where you see all that kinds of situations with people that don't have a place to rest. And then come into the United States and learn that the United States has a problem with people experiencing homelessness. You might never imagine that, because of course, foreigners, we understand United States according to what we see on the movies. And what we see on the movies is nobody's homeless. Everybody has a mansion. Everybody has a car. Everybody has two children, a dog, and a white fence. And then the people who are experiencing homelessness have to fit certain stereotypes. And coming from Mexico and learning that, oh, no, it's not like that. There's a lot of people who are experiencing homelessness. There's a lot of children who are in this situation. And it could be anybody. I mean, if anything we've learned from the pandemic is that people are literally a paycheck away from being homeless. So I know this is tough, but can you tell us about the statistics?
Sure. So you're right, Laura, that it's not really top on the consciousness of lots of people in this national community, because we think, and the world thinks, that the U.S. is the land of plenty, where, you know, there's this whole idea of the American dream, and that, you know, everybody can be middle class at least and have all the basic needs in place and all that sort of stuff. And when you think about poor people or homeless people, especially homeless children, you think about other parts of the world, places we think of as developing nations. But the average age of a homeless person here in the United States is 9 years old, and there are up to 2 million teenagers in the United States every single year who are experiencing homelessness on their own without their parents or guardians with them. And, you know, a big portion of people experiencing homelessness in the U.S. are homeless in families. So their whole families, including children, homeless. And, you know, the average age being 9 doesn't mean that we have a whole bunch of 9-year-olds out there all by themselves on the streets. That certainly happens in this nation, potentially, But mostly what that means is, if you think of it this way, someone who is 18 years old and she has a baby and she's homeless as a single parent, the average age between them is 9 years old, right? I'm no math expert, but that's how that average comes. You know, there are certainly children and especially young adults who are homeless without their parents or guardians, and, you know, quite astonishing rates across this nation, but also lots and lots of women, lots of families, lots of little kids are homeless in their families. And again, you may not be aware of this. They may not be visible to you because families, children, homeless youth, one of the best ways that they manage to survive and avoid criminalization and stigma and predation and exploitation and all those sorts of things is by sort of blending in and not being conspicuous in their homelessness and, you know, not admitting it to other people and maybe even themselves. And there are so many different ways that people sort of make their lives work. So they might not even think of themselves as homeless, even though they meet what, you know, what a common sense definition of homelessness would be.
Yeah. And we were talking about what that means exactly. And I was sharing with Jake, and this is not to make a sob story or to, you know, it's not about me. But I did experience homelessness when I was young. And I was telling Jake, you know, we were stranded in Cancun. And I know a lot of people might think, oh yeah, stranded in Cancun, that's a paradise. It's not when it's 100 degrees and you don't have food or shelter or drinking water. And yeah, so that was something I experienced for a very short time. Thank you, goddess, in Mexico. And it does totally meet the criteria of being homeless, because it's not only the people that are all day asking for help on the street. Homelessness could be a myriad of situations, including having a shelter, but a shelter that is not meant to be lived on, such as was my situation with my mom. How do people manage? How do they do it? I mean, same, like abandoned structures and abandoned houses. You know, when is one considered to be living an experience of homelessness?
That's a good question. And I think you're right on track about a bunch of those answers. But, you know, the government has a kind of complicated definition of homelessness and what someone has to sort of satisfy in order to prove that they're eligible for homelessness services that are funded by the government. But really, anybody who doesn't have a safe, stable, legal place to be that is meant for human habitation, has, you know, utilities like water and heat and electricity, where they are allowed to stay every night for as long as they want. In my mind, that's what constitutes homelessness. And again, you know, it's, there are a lot of sort of gray areas where people might not think of themselves or other people as homeless, where people are squatting in an abandoned building, in a garage, in a storage unit where they're not really allowed to be staying, where they don't have plumbing or, you know, things like that, where it's not meant for someone to be living, or, you know, sleeping in their car. Lots and lots of families sleep in their cars. Also, often you have people do what we call doubling up. So there might be more than one family, maybe even many people living in one sort of small apartment, so that they can all have a place to sleep, but they certainly don't all have bedrooms, and they might not even all have beds. And they're, you know, not all on the lease and not legally allowed to be there. But that's just part of how people are resourceful and resilient and find ways to sort of make their lives work. And especially women, especially queer people, especially young people are just really creative about figuring out how to make their lives work without having a stable, safe, legal place to be. Lots of young people resort to what we call survival sex trading, which means that they trade sex for a place to take a shower, to sleep for the night, or even just for an hour or two to get in elements. Lots and lots of women do that. Also, you know, women for, you know, thousands of years across all parts of the world have, in some ways, this is even sort of endorsed as part of culture. Women just sort of put up and put out to find places to stay with their kids and their family. They put up with violence. They, you know, do things they shouldn't have to do to be able to keep their housing because, you know, women, young people, people of color, indigenous people are not imbued with lots of power and privilege in our nation. And so oftentimes they have to meet their basic needs in these other kinds of ways, in these sort of scrappy and creative ways, which, you know, have a lot of stigma around them, have a lot of potential risk and lots of potential cost for them, but people do what they have to do to survive. And, you know, the people that I've known who are experiencing homelessness are just some of the most resilient people you could ever hope to meet. But also that's not to say that it's easy at all. And I think a lot of folks who have never experienced homelessness may be unaware of how precarious our housing situations are for most of us in this nation, even though we have this kind of, you know, denial about homelessness as an epidemic. Really, lots and lots and lots of Americans who have never even considered the possibility of being homeless are actually really just one or two paychecks away from homelessness. That's something that I think a lot of people have come close to in their awareness during this last pandemic, when a lot of people have lost their income and employment and so on. And, you know, just recently in some jurisdictions or across the nation, there were moratoria on evictions during the pandemic, but those all, as far as I know, most places or maybe everywhere have lapsed by now. And so we're seeing a big flood of people being evicted for not having been able to pay their rent over the course of the pandemic. So, you know, really things are quite precarious, even though this is the richest nation in the world. And part of that is because there's no place in the whole nation, not a single town, county, state, not a jurisdiction anywhere where someone can afford housing costs on minimum wage, which means that we in the United States have set up our economy on purpose so that lots and lots and lots of people, especially poor people, people of color, have no real viable way to make ends meet. We've set that up on purpose. We keep ratifying that as how our economy is set up. We have a minimum wage that nobody can live on anywhere in the nation. We have a Social Security plan where nobody can possibly afford housing costs on Social Security income, disability income, and so on. And we keep continuing that in this nation. So we shouldn't be surprised that we have this epidemic of homelessness that started really in the 80s with the way things sort of shifted in the government funding priorities and the way there started being more and more sort of less tax revenue drawn from the top income brackets and fewer and fewer safety net protections that were funded. And the government itself acknowledges that most of the people in this nation who meet their own requirements, eligibility for subsidized housing, will never get it. Only about 10% of people in the United States who qualify for subsidized housing by the government's own standards actually will ever be able to get subsidized housing, because there's so little of it, because there's so little affordable housing and so little funding for subsidized housing. So that's how we have so many people experiencing homelessness without ever really grappling with that much as a sort of national community.
And then, of course, after that, media, and I will always say Hollywood is the worst and the best thing that ever happened to humanity, because I love art, of course, and I love anything that is a creative outlet. But the stigmatization of people who are homeless, and we are fed and we are bombarded with this stereotype of, if a person is homeless, is because they're lazy, is because they're dumb, or undoubtedly is because they're drug addicts and or thieves, or I mean the worst of the worst in humanity. And that is not truth. And I think it's part of the big machine that makes it work, that puts that out there, you know, the stigmatizing. And what struck me earlier is when you say how children and family are very creative to blend in, because as a truth, the people who are most visible are the people who have the privilege to be visible, which will be cisgender men. But why is this stereotype, and why is it so wrong that we buy into this stereotype and stigmatization of homeless people?
Well, that's a good question. I think part of why we have the stereotype is because it helps us all ignore the systemic and structural problems that we have in this nation that caused this homelessness crisis. It helps us not address the structural problems and demand changes in the way we set up our economy, things like that. It helps us, those of us who have the privilege of not ever experiencing homelessness, of managing to have our basic needs in place, it helps us with a sort of false sense of security, which, you know, we want to have. We want to believe in that American dream. You know, if I'm a good person and I do what I'm supposed to do and I follow the rules and I work hard, then everything's going to be fine for me, and so on. And I think, you know, we can sort of never betray the ridiculousness of that American dream myth, and never have to really take a hard look at some of the things that we are doing to our neighbors, and things that we are sort of codifying in our national community that cause things to be the way they are. It's also just easier to sort of dehumanize people and to ignore them and mistreat them and allow them to be criminalized or exploited if we believe that it's their fault and they deserve it because they did something wrong. It makes them, you know, seem different from us if we are people of privilege, and so on. So I think those are pieces of it. It also is sort of tangled up. I mean, homelessness is about racism, right? 98% of the homeless students in Chicago public schools are kids of color. And we have racism codified in our laws about housing, who can get housing, who can get financing to own a home, who can get leases, and when and where and under what circumstances, and how much income do they have to have. And all of that stuff is brashly racist. And it still exists from back, you know, in the days where nobody even seemed to care to hide that their policies were racist, when there was, you know, redlining and things like that were very public matters of law. But, you know, those laws and processes still exist, and still we're coming up with new, constantly coming up with new ways to replicate housing discrimination and so on. In this nation, we've got new laws in like our towns that criminalize people who experience domestic violence and make it harder for people to get leases, even if they've never broken the law, and things like that. And, you know, we allow all of that stuff because we think, you know, that someone experiencing homelessness has done something wrong, and so they deserve to sort of be punished, as if that's going to somehow cause them to make a different choice and not be homeless. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we know that addiction, for example, is a thing that's experienced way more than we acknowledge in this nation. And I think we, most of us understand about addiction that when someone is addicted, they don't, they're not choosing to use substances just for fun. But we have this idea that certain people should be allowed to use whatever substances they want. Say if they're, you know, our sons who are frat boys at college or whatever. But other people using substances deserve to hit rock bottom and stay there until they somehow solve their own problems, solve their addiction, solve their mental health difficulties, solve their physical difficulties without support, without services, without insurance, and so on. But, you know, homelessness is not a cure for addiction. It's not. There's no amount of, you know, punishing people that's going to change the fact that our economy is a homelessness factory and that our schools and houses of worship are not safe places to be queer and that families are kicking kids out for being gay or trans. And we're sort of tolerating that, that we're allowing homophobia and transphobia to result in homelessness for queer people at drastic, disproportionate rates and stuff like that. I think as long as we keep sort of nursing these stigmas, we can just pretend that things are different than they are in society and we don't have to do anything to make things better or to take responsibility.
I so wish that you could see me, Jake, because I am shaking my head here, like it's almost fallen. The intersectionality of racism and homophobia and transphobia and racism and, oh my goodness, I am so angry because this is created, especially as you say, to dehumanize people. I should know because I have been on that end of the stick many times. And once we dehumanize somebody, they're less than. So why worry? Why care, right? And then when I hear you saying about who might end up being homeless, and we see, again, through this last year and a half, 2 years almost, anybody can end up there. So to you who are listening, I know you're mad. I'm mad. I know Jake is mad. So I hope we all are really, really mad. And we start shifting that anger and that energy into the big, big, big little things that we can all do. And I think the most important one and the easiest one is if you have a child or a person in your family who is queer or trans, love them, please. That will take a big chunk of people who end up in a homeless situation out of the equation. Whatever people do with their genitals and whoever they love is none of your business. Just love them the same, please and thank you. Don't kick them out of your house. Thank you. Don't be a racist, and not being quietly a racist don't work anymore. You have to be anti-racist and loud. You have to be loudly anti-racist. And these are two of the little things that I think we can do to ease the situation. But Jake, I know you are a person that has numbers and statistics. So what are some actually realistic and practical things, if any, that we can do to help people lead a better life and not be homeless?
Well, I think to sort of keep on talking about the stigma thing, part of the reason that we have stigma is because it also allows us to walk past somebody that we identify as someone experiencing homelessness and not feel bad about our own lives and to sort of ignore them or think bad thoughts about them or treat them badly or whatever and not feel guilty. You know, if I walk out of a restaurant or a Broadway show or whatever, and there are people right outside there who don't have anything to eat and are scrabbling for just, you know, their basic needs. You know, if I have even a little bit of empathy, I'm gonna have to notice them and pay attention and maybe even feel bad myself. But feeling bad doesn't help anybody, right? I mean, empathy is definitely a great step. And trying to sort of second guess or interrogate your own assumptions. So, you know, the next time you see someone who's asking for food or asking for donations or whatever, just remember how complicated homelessness is, and interrogate your own assumptions about what led to that person's situation. But how can we all, I think Laura's asking, how can we all be sort of part of the solution? Again, we're not trying to make people sort of feel bad or feel guilty for your own, you know, if you're privileged enough to have your own basic needs in place, that's great. Be grateful for that. And then make sure that more and more people around us in our local and national communities have those same basic needs in place. So, you know, we can do things to pay attention to the way laws are written in our national community and in our local areas, and to advocate for budgets and funding priorities that make a more sort of equitable playing field for everyone, and that provide the kinds of basic services that people need when they're having a housing crisis or experiencing homelessness. So, you know, advocate that your elected officials are prioritizing dismantling homelessness, dismantling housing discriminations as they exist all over the place in our laws and in practice, and make sure you're pushing elected officials to prioritize safety net services and funding for housing and so on. Make sure you're not endorsing or voting for nuisance or crime-free ordinances in your local area, because that sounds like a great idea. Of course, we want crime-free places to live, but what those really mean is that they keep people out who probably need housing and are not actually making your neighborhood any more, any less safe. So they discriminate against people of color and people who have experienced domestic violence, people who are targeted by the prison industrial complex and by the justice, the racist justice system. So, you know, take a look at those in your local municipalities and so on, and make sure that you're not somehow making it harder with your voting, making it harder for homeless shelters to exist, for affordable housing to exist in your local jurisdiction, but just some really practical things that people can do. You know, I mentioned this PIT count that's coming up. If you actually want to get involved in a real way, you can probably volunteer for that PIT count and go out. You know, you'll have lots of company and support and training. Nobody will have to do this alone. You should not ever by yourself go, you know, accosting people on the street in the middle of the night. But, you know, you can participate in that. So find out, you know, who's sponsoring that in your local area. You know, if there's like an Alliance to End Homelessness or something like that, check in with them and find out if you want to get involved in that. Or just, you know, in general, volunteer at your area domestic violence shelters, homeless shelters, youth drops, and so on. Support them financially, collect supplies that they might need. Every agency probably relies on donations of food and toiletries and socks and clothes and things like that to make their agency work, bus cards and cab fare and things like that. So, you know, one interesting exercise you can do for yourself if you like is to pay attention to all the things you need to take care of yourself over the course of a day. And next time, you know, you're going about acquiring the things you need, get two of each thing and donate one of each. So this morning I use shampoo, I brush my teeth, I use deodorant, I use clothes. You know, and this time of year I need extra long johns and hat and gloves and stuff like that. So just buy one of each of those things and send them to the, you know, to your neighborhood homelessness shelter. If you don't have a neighborhood homelessness shelter, find out why and figure out what you can do to fix that. But, you know, bring food there. Lots of these programs have service groups who bring hot meals. And sometimes, you know, those things happen in a building. Sometimes they happen in an outdoor location where, you know, there's a space where people are getting food or supplies. So you can contribute to those things and volunteer with them. Be nice to everyone. Be kind and generous and gentle with the people that you see around you. Don't ignore them. Wish them a good day. Don't think mean thoughts about them or say mean things to or about them. Those are all some really concrete things that people can do. And, you know, the list goes on. There are so many things that we can do to work on making the world a more equitable place. But those are just some really kind of concrete everyday solutions. In addition to what Laura was saying about trying to eradicate homophobia and transphobia in schools and houses of worship and in families and in communities.
Yeah, and if you're gonna help and if you're gonna do any of the things that Jake was just mentioning, please do me a huge favor and do not take photos, because that is something that is also has become like trendy when people go and help other people and then they film it or they take photos. That also helps dehumanizing folks who are experiencing homelessness. So please let's not do that. Performative allyship, not cool. It does not give you cool points. So don't do that. Jake, is there anything else that we haven't said tonight that needs to be said?
I think also just carry on this conversation, bring up this topic. You know, if you're with people who, especially if people are making comments about homelessness or things like that, you know, share some statistics. Think together with them about what it means that you have housing and what that means for you. Because most of us take for granted, you know, what having housing means for us and how it helps us in our lives, what it represents and all the things we do at our homes that someone else can't do if they don't have homes and so on. Definitely talk to the children in your life about homelessness, help them figure out ways to understand it. And you know, that no one should be more afraid of homeless people, because homeless people are actually more vulnerable than housed people, not more dangerous. And you know, most homeless people are super vulnerable, and you know, are just trying to find ways to make their lives work, and they're more likely to be sort of harassed by police and criminalized and prosecuted, and so on. Also, there are companies that, for example, I've been seeing an ad lately, and we're not necessarily endorsing any company, but you know, there's a company called Bombas that makes, they have this policy where for every pair of socks you buy for them, they donate a pair of socks to a homelessness service agency, because socks are one of the most requested items for people experiencing homelessness. You know, so, you know, next time you're buying a gift for somebody, then, you know, buy them some socks or underwear or t-shirts from that company and say, and hey, a great thing about this company is not only do they have these super cute socks, but, you know, for these three pairs of socks that I just gave you, three pairs of socks were given to somebody who's, you know, 17 years old and was kicked out of their home for being gay and doesn't have a place to live. Or something like that, as a sort of education tool, as well as a sort of practical solution.
I think that it's a great idea, and always check in your local communities, you know, try to be part of that circular economy and also circular sustainability to your own community. I want to share very quickly where I live. Very close to where I live, they open a shelter for people who experience homelessness. And a lot of people in the community were on uproar, you know, like, oh my God, crime, this and that. You know what, folks? Nothing happened. Nothing happened. And there is a space here that house people, I think, at night and gives them food. And nothing happened. I mean, there, you know, the world's still turning. So help change those policies and help people. You know, I think that'll be my signing note. Jake, I like to thank you as always for bringing your expertise and all your knowledge into this show, into this series. I am very honored and very proud to be doing this social justice series with you. And may we continue doing it on forever and ever. We know the needs are great, and great as in there are too many. Know that they're great because they're good. Anyway, I'm going to stop talking. I'll give you the microphone so you can say goodbye to your audience, Jake.
Thanks, Laura, for making a platform to talk about this important topic and all these topics that are all sort of tangled up together and intersectionally connected that we've been talking about. I believe next month we're talking about racism and racial allyship, and that's absolutely connected to everything else we've been talking about, just like all the other topics have been. Thanks to everyone who's coming to this podcast to learn about ways to be a community member among community members, where we might all have differences, where diversity is a beautiful thing, where we need to look out for and stick up for each other. Thanks for all the ways that you are learning to and practicing ways to do that in your own life and in your own world.
Thank you, everybody who's listening live. Thank you to anybody who might listen later. And thank you, obviously, to Circle Sanctuary Network Podcast for giving us the opportunity to bring these topics to light. Thank you, Jake, for being here. And to everybody, we'll see you next Monday, obviously, with more Lunatic Mondays. And until then, never forget that you are loved. Bye-bye.
And thank you for joining us on the Circle Sanctuary Network Podcast, presented by Circle Sanctuary and produced for all who follow the Nature Center paths. Join us here throughout the week for various programming, connecting the community around the world. And please don't forget to watch for updates on the Circle Sanctuary website at www.circlesanctuary.org. And follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/CSNpodcasts. We can also be found on your favorite podcast hosting sites, such as iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and others. And until next time, many blessings.